Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You know that feeling you get when you see an abandoned building? It's that weird, internal, uncanny valley moment. Because it's just wrong. It's that feeling that only intensifies when it's somewhere that looks like it was abandoned too soon or too abruptly. In the rural areas I grew up in, there are an exorbitant amount of these buildings. From what little I retained of middle school history, the town was hit hard during the Depression. With so few residents to begin with, the men leaving was near catastrophic. In a small town, these kinds of hardships can have the townsfolk take flight without much thought. This meant that a lot of businesses shut down right in the middle of operations, including the former main source of jobs around here, the old toy factory. The combination of creepy old dolls and unforeseen abandonment naturally bred tall tales. For years, the handful of teens in our town had dared each other to do what teens do. Dumb things. In the most cliché way possible, they'd dare each other to break in, spend the night, etc. With decades worth of ghost stories surrounding the building, it was some sort of rite of passage. None of them could ever be verified, but there were plenty of gruesome tales to be told about that facility. They often come with sparse or varying details, as oral tradition can encourage over time. One story that scared the hell out of me as a kid was about a woman who we'll just name Clara. The version my dad always told me went as follows. At the start of the draft, Clara found herself with a war-torn family and subsequently without income. As many women of the time were forced to do, Clara sought out a job. As one could guess, her best option at the time was some menial work at the factory. Working in production wasn't the most riveting of jobs, but it's easy and, bottom line, it was money. As if things didn't seem bleak enough, Clara had become pregnant. As exciting as this news would have been normally, it incited more dread than anything. She had found out shortly after her husband left, so was forced to push through on her own. About 7 months into the pregnancy, Clara's supervisor discreetly informed her that she would need to take leave approaching her delivery. Already at a loss for how she would care for the child and maintain her job after her delivery, the news that she would be losing 3 months of income devastated her. The notice arrived soon after, only piling onto her grief. Her husband would be making it home, but only in a pine box. Clara grew increasingly reclusive over the next couple months, not even showing her face at her husband's funeral. It wasn't until one Monday morning that Clara finally made her reappearance. With her hair in curls and her finest Sunday dress on, she boldly greeted all the factory workers with her new baby. At once, all the women let out gasps of varying degrees before being stunned into silence. After a full 60 seconds of unsettling quiet, a scream erupted from an older woman before she fell to her knees, sobbing. Some versions of the story even say the shock caused a heart attack that subsequently killed her. There Clara was, her lips a vibrant red and her eyes black as night. She was leaning her back against one of the machines, sitting with her legs neatly crossed, held against her bosom, mimicking the Madonna and child. Her daughter lay limp. The umbilical cord still connected the mother and child like a string of fate. The baby's chest cavity had been crudely torn open and emptied of all organs. and most of the internals were strewn about with reckless abandon, except for the heart. The heart was clutched in the mother's hand with a portion missing, chewed off and coating Clara's lips, brighter than any lipstick could. Clara had gouged her eyes and cut her tongue out. Her stomach had been sliced open, the last clumsy work of a blind woman. She had been unable to look at her own abhorrent actions or taste her unborn daughter's heart. But it didn't stop her. We'll never know why Clara did what she did, but for whatever psychosis she experienced, it compelled her to commit such an atrocity. Some people say she refused to bring her daughter into such a cruel world, eating her heart to forever bonds them even in death. Others say it was simply an act of evil and resentment towards the consequence of her pregnancy. Whatever the case, it is said that Clara still haunts the factory today. She weeps blood from her eyeless sockets and sobs from the gaping maw that had once been her mouth. In her left hand, she clutches the infant's beating heart, and in her right, she holds the umbilical cord. Her fetus hangs at the end of the umbilical cord, its dead eyes somehow always trained on those unlucky enough to witness the apparition. As an 8-year-old, I was absolutely terrified by the imagery. I have no shame in admitting that I was a scaredy-cat as a kid, too spooked to even read scary stories to tell in the dark or watch Goosebumps until I was in middle school. I attribute this to an incredibly overactive imagination that I was unable to control. In my adulthood, I have embraced all things spooky into my career, but I'll touch more on that later. My dad was often woken up in the night by my irrational insistence that someone or something was going to kill me. He'd trudge down the hall, walk the perimeter of my room, and check every crevice. Unsurprisingly, there was never a trace of any murderer, a ghost, or demon. That wouldn't mean anything, however, when I was convinced once again a week later. Somehow, this never deterred him from painting images of horror as my bedtime stories, even if they were presented as cautionary tales. I was obviously too scared to ever even go near the facility for much of my childhood. As terrifying as the tale of Clara may be on its own, it wasn't the only deterrent, not even close. I'll give you one more of my town's urban legends surrounding that old factory. Not long after the factory had closed, the tradition of teenagers breaking and entering began. For the most part, it was all fun and games. All through the 1950s, teens routinely sought out the factory to prove their status as a cool cat. Such were the intentions of two teenage boys called Danny and Michael. The two were the kind of best friends who did everything together, and this rite of passage was no exception. On the last weekend of summer before high school, the two decided they would enter this new chapter of their lives with an already impressive reputation. The minuscule size of the town allowed their claims of bravado to travel fast. By late afternoon, every teenager and the rare trusted adult knew Danny and Michael's intentions. The boys had managed to avert any parental suspicion with an easy lie about an end-of-summer sleepover, as had been customary throughout their lives. As the sun set, Danny and Michael left their houses with overnight bags in their hands. A quick bike ride, and they arrived at the entrance of the factory. What happened after that is unknown. The two of them brought the exact events of that night with them to the grave. There are a few things we do know about that night for certain. The boys spent at least enough time inside to smoke a pack of cigarettes, set up a little camp, and change their clothes. In fact, it looked like the two of them had been prepared to sleep, but never quite got that far. They were found 2 days later, but it wasn't in the factory at all. After failing to come home by the afternoon and some digging around amongst the local teens, their parents became increasingly worried. Naturally, after some coerced teen confessions, they checked the factory first and found only remnants of the boy's presence. The police were involved almost immediately. Two missing teenagers raised red flags immediately, especially with murmurings of the infamous factory's involvement. So they searched. They poked in, around, and anywhere near the old building. No further sign of the two came up for 2 whole days. And then they appeared. Danny and Michael emerged from the woods around 6 p.m., right as the sun was setting. There were a few townsfolk who saw them and rushed to their sides. The state of the boys was beyond anything they'd ever seen, and bear in mind that a good few of the men were veterans. Danny's left arm was completely devoid of skin from the elbow down, just raw muscle and tendons exposed. On his other arm, the boy had open gouges along the entire length, deep enough to see the bone. His face was massacred beyond recognition. One eyeball was entirely missing, as were his lips and tongue. His nose had been sliced clean down the middle, the 2 halves hanging on by strings of cartilage. His legs were covered in deep scratches of near animalistic proportions, and upon further inspection, it was discovered that his left foot was entirely gone. Filling his shoe was simply a bony nub with what appeared to be more animalistic teeth marks. Michael hadn't fared any better than his companion. While his skin may have been mostly present, his features were not. His right arm was entirely gone up to the shoulder, as was his right ear and left hand. His left leg was gone up to the thigh, leaving the distinct question of how the hell he had made such a long trek, hobbling on only 1 foot. The strangest part, there was no blood, not a drop. The wounds appeared, healed, as if they had been there for years. Scar tissue had even formed in some spots. Doctors later on would baffle over how the boys had even survived 2 days with such wounds, much less healed them. When the group who had discovered them finally spoke, they asked the most natural question. "Who did this to you?" The boys, turning to face each other for a moment, smiled. The smiles were barely distinguishable due to their injuries, but they were present enough to note nonetheless.
"He did,"
Michael spoke, first through garbled speech.
"Just like I did to him. It's okay."
And that was it. The 2 boys let out final wheezing laughs in unison and collapsed, dead at the edge of the forest. While it haunted me a lot less than the ghost story, this one always stuck with me too. According to some, there was a patch of dirt there that refused to sustain life to this day. I have seen the patch, and it is barren still. I'm certainly not saying it's due to the curse of Danny and Michael, but it did creep me out when I was younger. There are plenty more stories, but those were the 2 that stuck with me most vividly. Kids over the years continuously made up more and more stories until it was hard to tell where some of them even started. Hell, there was even jump rope songs written about the tragedies. Imagine a handful of kids gathered together, declaring to a cheerful tune, "Don't go down to the factory of old. Don't risk your life. We've all been told. Don't go down to the factory at night. You might lose your tongue and sight." It's a bit unnerving in retrospect. When I was 16, I made the decision to rebel in the little way that had become local commonplace. It was prom night. I was trying my hardest to impress the girl I liked, and there was a decent amount of fruit-flavored vodka in my system. So, when one of the guys in our group suggested we attempt a good old haunted break-in, I agreed. I pushed back all of the fear and trepidation that had been ever present in my adolescence, and replaced it with the kind of bravery only peer pressure can produce. As we made our way through the overgrown fields surrounding the lot, I mentally thanked my past decision of a shorter dress, as opposed to anything with tulle. Our two other female companions had both chosen longer dresses and were struggling a hell of a lot more than I was. Nonetheless, we pressed on. Years ago, the town had stopped its attempts of keeping the windows boarded up. The building had been dilapidated beyond repair, and the persistence of teens was never-ending. Thus, it didn't take us very long to find a way in. A couple of kicks at a particularly weak spot, and boom, we're free to enter as we dared. I won't drag this part of the story on for too long, as with any urban legends, the actual experience rarely leads up to the hype. We all made a few lame attempts to make the experience spookier than it really was, sneaking up behind each other or kicking a dusty machine transformed into a jump scare. Later on, the guys would swear that they saw the speedy flitting of a ghost or two while inside. Everyone wanted to believe them, so it became a universal truth among us. That night, I returned home and was greeted by a smirk from my dad. One look at my tousled hair and mud-covered shoes told him all he needed to know.
"Any apparitions or disgruntled workers?"
he asked with a shake of his head.
"Yep, full apparitions, actually,"
I responded with a snort and a shake of my head right back.
"At least according to the boys. Personally, I don't think any of those spooky stories you told me will ever scare me again. It did kind of look cool in there, though."
"Oh, come on, kiddo," he replied. "You loved those stories as a kid. Don't act like I didn't catch you watching horror movies when you're supposed to be asleep."
I couldn't help but laugh.
"Okay, but the reoccurring nightmares came way before my appreciation. The scariest part of that experience was the trip to get there after a night of dancing. I'm so sore.
But hey,"
my dad called out after me when I was halfway up the stairs,
"don't go sniffing around abandoned places, okay? They can be dangerous. All kinds of rust and mold and glass and stuff you probably don't want to see anyway. Scariest thing isn't going to be the ghosts."
"Okay, okay,"
I groaned in the way that only teenagers can seem to muster up.
"My urban exploration days are long behind me. Good night."
That, of course, proved to be a big old lie. Not intentionally, per se, but I did continue my urban exploration into adulthood. See, while we may not have seen what we sought after that night, I did notice something enticing to me. Walking into that creepy, abandoned factory was a rush. Ghost-free, but a rush nonetheless. There was an exhilaration to finally experiencing the truth for myself. It helped spark a passion in me that later evolved into a decently successful journalism career. I was 25 when I returned back to my town, camera and laptop in hand. I still visited a couple times a year for holidays, but I had moved from the small area at 18 to pursue university with no intention of moving back. I hadn't even stayed for more than a week at a time in those 7 years. I loved my family, but work was demanding, and so was being back in the place I grew up. This time, though, I was going to be there for a full month. I had put all of my work into the project that brought me home, and I didn't plan to rush it in the slightest. I had acquired a decent enough following to fund something I had long envisioned.
Over the years, I had spent a significant amount of time urban exploring. It started out as photography during college and eventually evolved into a project displaying my two greater abilities. Haunting, often grimy photos paired with enticing stories about the history surrounding the building was my niche. I'm sure it's obvious, but I had the idea to do a piece surrounding my town early on. The decision to hold off on it was intentional. I knew that this one would be deeply personal and likely inspired by more passion than any other. I wanted to wait for the best opportunity, and there was no time better. I knew it would catapult my career forward if I did a good enough job. Arriving home, I was greeted with more hugs than I could count from my family. Admittedly, my family is small. My mom died when I was young, young enough that I can't remember her at all. My dad didn't even keep pictures of her because he said it was too painful. My mom's family hated my dad. That's what they told me. They never approved of their relationship, much less their creation of me. When my mom died, my dad was exiled even more, and they cared more about their resentment of him than a grandkid. It's all I've ever known, so it never really bothered me much. My dad's family was pretty much non-existent as well. Aside from my aunts, they were all either dead or estranged in some manner. Apparently, there was a lot of dark stuff running on that side of the family. Mental illness, addiction, suicide, stuff that aunt and dad only mentioned a couple times vaguely. Suffice it to say, we were close. The three of us didn't have anyone but each other, so naturally our relationships held a lot of value. Within a couple hours, my aunts had cooked up the kind of meal you can't replicate in a restaurant, and they had hounded me with questions. I told them about my career, this opportunity, and my plan for the project. While their excitement for my success was undeniable, there was still the very apparent nerves running through my dad.
"I should have known you'd end up doing this someday,"
my dad pointed out, his joking tone tinged with more nerves.
"You always had to rebel just a little bit, huh? You remember what I told you, though? After all those silly stories?"
"Yes, Dad," I groaned, feeling a little bit like I was 16 again. "I haven't forgotten because you've told me a million times before."
"Look, you never know what you're gonna run into out there," he said softly, his eyes darting over to my aunt for just a brief moment. "Just be safe, and don't go poking your nose into more trouble than you can handle."
The conversation lightened up after that, and I could only hope that they'd chill out over the course of the next month. I knew it was natural that they'd be worried about me, but I was an adult now. I won't bore you with too many details of the next couple of weeks. The first week, I spent enough time inside that grungy factory to become deeply acquainted. I took pictures non-stop. I sought after every possible shot I could. The creepier, the better. I will admit that I never once saw a ghost, only spiderwebs and rust. The 2 weeks after that was research. I scoured the library, town records, and the little bit of knowledge the internet had to offer. I interviewed as many townsfolk as I could, and acquired over a dozen stories about that factory. All crazier than the last. I was only able to confirm a few facts, though, as one might expect. One, there was a woman called Clara who had died in the factory. Her obituary, however, told me very little. All it cited was that she died of unusual circumstances related to factory operations, and the dates. At the very least, it told me that her story was based in the tiniest modicum of truth. And two, there were two boys who went missing after allegedly visiting the factory one night. The more gruesome details of their story were nowhere to be found, as I expected.
They were found in the woods by a group of people in some sort of dire state beyond saving. But that was as far as it went. They, too, most certainly died, even if the details weren't exact. The rest of the deaths I found related to the old building were typically ruled as machinery malfunction, which wasn't the rarest thing at that time. The only thing left to do at that point was to write, edit, and get some last-minute shots of other abandoned businesses. It would help set the scene of this rural town left behind in the wake of industrialism. Since I'd left, even more places had become abandoned. It was sad, honestly, but not surprising. If I had never decided to approach the woods, my life would be easier. I wouldn't wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat. Images I couldn't forget clouding my vision. I wouldn't have spent months reevaluating my entire life and trying my hardest to avoid an existential crisis. The fact of the matter, however, is that I did approach the woods that day. One seemingly perfect afternoon, I set out through the field where the two boys were found. The woods and the field had been abandoned long ago, just as the factory had. The spots that refused to grow anything was bare as ever, but everything else was overgrown entirely. Sometimes it felt like the whole town was just a couple years away from being abandoned entirely. At the time, this seemed like a good thing for my project. Overgrown, spooky woods where the bodies of two young boys were found. It could only increase the ambience I was going for. My dad and aunt would be furious if they found out where I was headed, but I figured I could handle it. My mistake began when I went deeper into the woods than I should have, having too much faith in myself. The artistic part of my brain drove me deeper and deeper into the thick brush. The lighting only seemed to get better as I delved deeper. So what was there to stop me? The echoing of adult voices from childhood was silenced. "Don't go into the woods. Nothing good ever comes from those woods," was replaced with, "Come on, look at that lighting. Look at those trees. They're asking to be part of your creepy article." The smell. That's what stopped me in my tracks for a moment. It was subtle at first, a sickly smell in the distance. For a while, I could pass it off as some dead animal in the distance. The 300 people who lived in the town may be too scared to occupy these woods, but the animals still thrived. Then, it got worse, and worse, and worse, until it was stronger than one dead deer could produce. I had been in my fair share of woods over the years, and I have never experienced something this overwhelming. I'd gone deep enough into the forest now that I could no longer see the edges of the field anymore. In the distance, I saw something. I couldn't make out what it was at first, but it became apparent soon enough. It was another abandoned building. It was a cabin or a shed, as dilapidated as my usual subjects. I couldn't believe it. I thought this was a stroke of luck I could have never predicted. The smell was still stronger now, but I had weirdly grown a bit accustomed to it by then. I could press on further, for the sake of the peace. I was able to rationalize everything by backtracking on my old thoughts. Maybe some big predator had just been particularly fruitful. Maybe the smell was just due to some lucky cougar's feast. I knew this sounds stupid now, but in situations like that, your brain does everything it can to rationalize what's going on. I surely didn't want to believe anything was out of the ordinary. I had survived hours upon hours in the scariest place in town. What was the worst that could happen at some forgotten cabin? It only took me a few minutes to reach the cabin, and the smell continually got worse.
It was pretty obvious at this point that it was coming from inside the derelict structure. Any reasonable person would have turned around immediately. But sometimes my passion outweighs my reason. The door was locked as I tugged on the knob, but I could see that the hinges were severely rusted. I'm a decently strong girl, so a few kicks with my boots and the door fell back. I expected there to be a loud noise as it slammed against the door, but quite the contrary. There was an odd, squishy noise as it fell, which would have floored me were there not a more pressing issue. The smell. It was so strong that I gagged instantly and yanked my jacket up over my face, zipping it up tight. It curbed the odor just enough for me to avoid actually vomiting. Once I was able to regain my breath and push past the smell, I could begin to register what was inside the cabin. At first, I thought it was furniture, covered in old, dirty sheets. I'd experienced that quite a few times in my line of work, but there was something distinctly different. It felt familiar, but wrong. How did I describe it earlier? Uncanny Valley. The sheets were covering something. Lots of somethings. But it certainly wasn't furniture. Furniture doesn't ooze through sheets, typically. Especially not with thick, rust-colored liquid. Furniture doesn't let off the specific scent saponification can. And this certainly wasn't soap. My hand was vibrating like a hummingbird's wings as I reached for the corner of the closest sheet. My mind knew what was happening, but I couldn't move my feet. I couldn't leave this abominable scene until I was sure of what I suspected. I was only able to see one bloated, bruised hand before I took off. I was running faster than I ever had before, bile finding its way up my throat. The smell was stuck in my nose, and every single part of me felt dirty. I felt like the decay had taken over my very body, almost as if I had become one of the corpses. I fell to my knees as soon as I reached the famous clearing. Vomit and bile spilled out of me, as I did. As disgusting as it was, I was almost grateful, because it beat the taste and smell of decay that was suffocating me. The first number I dialed was 911. I wasn't sure if they could make out exactly what I was saying, but I managed to give them my location and convey my frantic nature enough that the dispatch was immediate. The next person I called was my dad. It took a few minutes for him to calm me down enough so I could explain what happened. The line went silent for a moment after I choked out my story. "Dad," I wheezed out as the sirens in the distance grew closer.
"You call the cops?"
he finally asked. I thought it was strange for a first question after your daughter tells you that she found roughly 15 to 20 dead bodies. But hey, traumatic situations affect everyone differently.
"Did you call the cops? Where are they?"
I can see their lights. They're not far," I finally answered, with confusion evident in my tone. "But, Dad, did you hear me? There's some kind of maniac out here. Some kind of serial killer in this town. And I just unveiled it."
"I know,"
he said. His tone suddenly so serious it gave me chills. His voice sounded different. It wasn't the same as the father I loved.
"I just hoped you never would."
The line went dead. I held my phone in my hand, the look of disbelief on my face. I barely had time to process what was happening before the cops arrived and began hounding me with questions. My head was spinning, and I found myself in the back of a cop car. I can't even remember what I told them, but it must have been enough. They found the bodies, and I was taken to the station. The first thing I tried to do at the police station was call my dad once more. No reply. Straight to voicemail. Then, my aunt. Same thing. I felt anxiety building up in my chest. My dad's ominous words paired with the entire situation. It's obvious to say that something was wrong here. But it was something deeper. Something way more wrong than what first appeared. Hours later, I was kindly escorted back to my family's home. My voice had gone raw from the tears and seemingly endless statements I was asked to make. I walked to the door in some sort of trance, completely unsure of what I would find when I returned. I unlocked the door and swung it open. "Dad?" I called out once I stepped inside the dark house. "Auntie?" There was only silence, causing me to shake my head as I flipped the light switch. I stopped, dead in my tracks, as my surroundings came into clear view. It looked like we had been robbed, except in the most careful way possible. Almost everything personal was gone. All the furniture remained, but anything that seemed remotely specific to my family was just gone. I would find out later that my aunt's house was found to be in the same exact state by the time the cops got there. I jogged upstairs, peeking my head around every corner, into every room. There was nothing. Nothing until I reached my old room. The only room that had anything personal left in it. On my bed was a single envelope with my name written in my dad's familiar script. I swallowed heavily as I sat on the comforter and held it in my hands. There was no way anything in this envelope could hold good information. I just knew that in my soul. Nonetheless, I opened it with shaking hands and began to read.
"Kiddo, I know this letter isn't going to reach you in the best circumstances. Probably the worst if we're being honest here. Honesty. That's something our relationship's been lacking from the beginning. But you have to understand, honesty meant losing you and whatever family we had built for ourselves. I can't say whether you'll view us as a family after everything, but know that I always will. There's a dark part to us all, even if it may display a little differently. Some people's dark parts manifest in the forms of addiction, some in wrath, or some in selfishness. For the unluckiest among us, our dark parts plague us in all of these ways, and more. For whatever mistakes I made, there is no denying that you came out better than any parent could wish for. Your dark parts are so outshined by the bright parts of you. I have envied you for this forever, and so has your aunt. See, we are the kind of people whose dark parts are inescapable. We are the unlucky few who cannot overcome the way our brains nag and pull at us to do the wrong thing, to make the wrong choices. That's how we found each other, years ago, in the deepest depths of our darkness. You were born in May. That is the truth. But I wasn't there for the birth. I wasn't there until you were 6 weeks old. I only met your mother once, and while her family resents me to this day, well, it's not for any reasons we told you. I didn't know you were there when it began. I didn't know that in this stranger's car I would find a wide-eyed, curious, and innocent baby. Contrary to popular belief, even us devils might have the occasional spark of guilt. I wanted to kill you. I wanted to be able to finish the job I had set out to do. I couldn't,
Your aunt couldn't either. Admittedly, she was always the one who doubted our work more than I ever did. This became an anomaly to me. Why was empathy suddenly a trait I possessed? I was sure it had escaped me long ago. The plan was to leave you somewhere, drop you off on a doorstep, and forget it ever happened. We could keep traveling, stay undetected, and never think of it again, but then your aunt proposed an idea. Despite the demonic desires in us, we still retain some semblance of humanity. She knew that both of us craved at least a mild sense of normalcy. She knew that we missed having a family, so why not create one? Few would suspect a tight-knit family in a small rural town of the atrocities we committed. We found this town by accident, after days of driving and trying to figure out where the hell we could possibly build this insane idea. We found it. There were a couple hundred people, and it was practically off the map. These were simple people who stuck to their ways. And hell, the police department isn't anything to write home about. We had changed our identities over the years numerous times, but this would be the last. At least, we hoped. I know now that it won't. The sheer existence of this letter shows that I never thought we were safe. Not truly. Things were good for the first few years. The dark desires stopped in us both for a while. Too distracted by raising a child to think about it. That's the thing about this darkness, though. It's never truly gone. Remember when we watched A Clockwork Orange as a kid? Remember how you said you don't understand why he kept doing bad things even after his rehabilitation? I couldn't admit to you that I completely understood. By the time we watched that movie, I had taken 6 more lives. Your aunt had assisted with 3 of them. As we told you it was just a movie, we knew in our hearts, as black as they may be, that it was a lie. You had been our rehabilitation. And despite our bold claims of being completely reformed, we returned to our own ways, just like Alex. We were good at scouting our victims. Hitchhikers, prostitutes, runaways, homeless folks. The tried and true nomads that the police brush aside. The kind of people that the LAPD would declare code no humans alive for. Never anyone local, never frequently enough to raise suspicions. Those business trips I was always on. Well, I'm sure you can piece that together. I'm not a fool. I couldn't have held this ruse up for as long as I did if I was. I know that we have been unfair to you, and I know that you will probably never see me as the father you grew up with again. I prepared myself for this possibility over the years. I just didn't think it would be this soon. I didn't think I'd miss out on grandkids. The people in this town, I knew they'd never find that cabin. I knew their superstition would keep it hidden. But you never quite fit in this town, did you? As much as I have thought about this over the years, I didn't allow my brain to consider the possibility that you'd be the one to find it. Our darkest secrets. It's unlikely that you'll ever find us. It's unlikely you will ever see your aunts or me again. It's probably better that way, right? And now that you know the truth, for all the lies, for all the violence, for all the sins, we never stopped loving you, not for a moment. It's unfortunate, but all those movies are a lie. Love can't conquer hate, not when the hate is deep inside of you and inescapable. All love can do is curb that hate a little bit for a little while. Dad. I won't outline what happened next. There was a lot of procedural police work, a lot of crying, a lot of catatonic days, and existential crises. The next 6 months are still a blur. Even now, whole chunks of that time are missing in my memories. It took a little while, but my biological mother was found. For 25 years, she had been a Jane Doe, but through DNA testing, we found her. She had been a single mom, doing what she could to get by. When he got to her, she had been a single mom, doing what she could to get by. When he got to her, she had been picking me up from a babysitter after a late double shift. Ironically, she had very little family as well. The only family member I was able to connect with after all of this was her sister. My biological aunt. My grandparents were long dead, and she had no kids. My biological father's identity was never found, so I'll die without meeting that side of my family. For a long time, the man I knew as my father was unidentified. He had been careful and covered his tracks. My aunt, the exact same. It was obvious that they were professionals at this, prolific as they were, and seemingly able to escape authorities. Then, something happened. The police submitted some of the trace DNA evidence into CODIS, scanning through millions of samples. They got a hit. Shockingly, my former father and aunt had only ever been caught on a couple petty crimes. Theft, trespassing, a few things like that. Turns out they weren't even siblings. Just partners in crime. They haven't been found, if you're wondering. It's been almost 10 years since I found that cabin, and a handful of years since they were identified. The case has gone cold for the most part, and a selfish part of me is grateful for that. As much as I want to bring them to justice, part of me worries it will make it all too real. I've managed to hold this suspension of disbelief in my mind for so long, I'm scared to see it go away. I want justice for the mother I never knew. I want justice for the childhood I lost. I want justice for all of those bodies I found covered in sheets and decay. Over half of them remain unidentified, with no leads. I just don't know when I'll be able to handle coming face to face with it. Coming face to face with the monsters that masqueraded as my family. The dreams I once had of a grieving mother hanging in an old factory are long gone. They were replaced with a different, reoccurring dream. My shaking hand slowly lifting a sheet, the scent of decay hitting my nostrils, and my feet moving as fast as possible. Sometimes in my dream, my dad is there. Sometimes my aunt. Sometimes they're laughing, and sometimes they're crying. It always ends the same, though. They hug me. And at first, I hug back. Then they don't let go. They squeeze me tight until the air is gone, and I'm sucked into darkness. That's how it always ends. The darkness always takes over. Just like that monster said. Just like when the darkness tries to take over, and I feel that depth and shameful pang of longing. Longing for the family I once had. Even if it was tainted with lies, death, and blood. I'm not like them, though. I tell myself that to make it better. Every day, I fight the darkness, but every day, I manage to win. I have a kid now, you see, and I owe it to her to give her the best childhood she could possibly have. My wife says I'm still trying to make up for my own childhood through our daughter. And maybe that's true. It could be worse, though. The piece I wrote about the town was put on hold for a while. But when I published it, it took off. My career went on a trajectory I could have only dreamed of. The addition of my gruesome discovery paired with the piece only added to its popularity. I know I need to tell my daughter about this at some point, but she is still young. Thinking about telling her still gives me anxiety. I have a long time until I have to face it, but the thoughts of watching the light in her turn to darkness plagues me. She is sunshine and happiness, but the words of that letter echo in my mind often. Love can't conquer hate. Not when the hate is deep inside of you and inescapable. I'm going to prove that it is inescapable. I'm going to prove him wrong and conquer the hate that threatens my sanity if it's the last thing I do. The light inside me and the light I passed on to my daughter will burn bright enough to destroy that dark shadow that hangs over my life. I have faith in that.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free. Select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.